recently, evolutionary biology has discovered that actually, yes, we do all have a shared common ancestor, and we actually share about half of our DNA, even with a banana, never mind with a fruit fly, whatever it might be, that we are truly relatives. And again, this is not just a gee whiz type of realization, but what it helps us to show is at the deepest archetypal layers, we share the experience of what it is to be alive with every other living entity. And that's something where biology has kind of validated indigenous wisdom.
This is Frontiers of Commoning with David Bollier.
My guest today is Jeremy Lent, a fearless, big-thinking author and self-described integrator who explores how we might rethink the foundations of civilization itself, which not surprisingly involves us examining our own lives. Lent's passion is exploring historical patterns of human thought, what he calls the cognitive history of humanity, as revealed by culture, economics, politics, psychology, religion, and many other disciplines. He wants to show us how the modern worldview has taken humanity to the edge of planetary crisis and how we can construct a new ecologically based civilization. After founding and leading a publicly traded internet company in the 1990s, Lent spent years charting a new course for himself. He went on to publish The Patterning Instinct in 2017, a book that synthesizes a vast academic and scientific literature to describe humanity's search for meaning, from the time of hunter-gatherers to early agricultural civilizations to the cultures of India, China, Islam, and Western Christianity. Now, in a kind of sequel to that book, Lent has published The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe. This book can be summarized in three short sentences. Our mainstream worldview has expired. What will replace it? A world of deep interconnectedness. The implications for the commons, a system of social relationships, are clear. In our conversation today, we're going to talk about the commons and the long sweep of human history, how it relates to ancient wisdom traditions such as Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and indigenous cultures, and how vanguard biological sciences increasingly see the world as a set of living relational systems. Welcome, Jeremy.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for that great introduction, David. It's a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
Well, I've been so enriched and enlarged through your books. I really am eager to talk about how you got onto this path, starting especially with The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. How does one plunge into such a project after being in the internet business world for so long?
You know, this was a real existential kind of meltdown that I went through that led to this big change in my own life. And in a way, I do think that has given me this ability to feel into the kind of transformations that we all need to take, that we all need to do to get to a different kind of society and a different kind of future. But for me personally, I'd actually, as you mentioned, spent the first half of my life in business, actually founded an internet company, took it public. I was sort of right there in the heart of that sort of neoliberal structures or whatever. Then a period happened when the things that I'd built my life around kind of collapsed around me. My wife, at the time she passed away some years back, got seriously ill with some chronic diseases, which became acute. And because of that, I left this company that I had founded and that I was CEO of, this internet company, to look after her full time. The company was too young, it became part of the dot-com crash. I left it too early, so it collapsed. Meanwhile, my wife that I'd spent my entire adult life with, she began to suffer cognitive decline. So even though I spent years looking after her welfare, I lost the partner that I had been with. And so I found myself alone. And in this kind of existential moment, it's a little bit like a crucible melting. I asked myself, where can I kind of redirect my life to make it truly meaningful so that I'm actually building a life not based on what somebody else tells me is meaningful, but what I believe is. So I started an actual investigation of my own. This is very personally driven. To find where meaning actually came from. And I was like peeling the onion, looking at these different concepts and trying to understand where they came from. And that's actually led me ultimately to write The Patterning Instinct, which was mostly, as I was doing this research, I was saying, I wish somebody had written a book helping me to find my way through these layers. Well, since I'm doing all this research, why don't I do that? And that also led to this other book, The Web of Meaning, that's just recently got published.
So you were doing this as a non-academic, as a former businessman. Surely you would have thought that some of the great thinkers out there would have addressed some of your questions, both as a personal venture as well as a civilizational critique.
Yes, and this is the thing I'm so grateful for, these innumerable deep thinkers who addressed each of my questions in different ways. But what I didn't ever find is somebody who was weaving together the different answers and the different explorations the different great thinkers have done out there. So this research of my own that went on for many years of my life, pretty much up to 10 years, was about looking at and learning what the great thinkers, both of the past and the present, have to say about all kinds of different topics. But then I feel like my own contribution is not to sort of go further deeper into any one of these places where people have gone so deep, but to simply weave together the insights so many people have already come up with into something that's more integrated, into something that helps us to see how science relates to spiritual traditions, or how the modern relates to past traditions. In fact, how things like spiritual investigation of the self relates to politics. And these are the kind of connections that I feel I've been able to make on the shoulders, if you will, of all these great thinkers that I've been grateful to read.
I would hasten to add that it's not a great book symposium the way the Aspen Institute or Robert Hutchins might do. I mean, it seems that your approach has a distinctly postmodern, post-capitalist perspective, as opposed to simply ratifying some of those great traditions.
Yes, that's completely true. And in fact, honestly, if I look at any of the great traditions, even the ones that I have the most respect for and most love for, things like Buddhism, Taoism, which I refer to a lot in my writings, none of them felt to me that they gave me the complete, full, comprehensive response to what is truly meaningful that I was looking for, that tied all the different elements together. And that's where I feel I've attempted to offer something that really does integrate the different strands of wisdom, the wonderful heritage we have of human thinking over many thousands of years.
Well, let's get a little more specific about what you mean by the cognitive history of humanity, or the term, the title of the book, The Patterning Instinct.
I mean, first, let's just look at that title, which only arose after years of my research, because part of the research I was looking at is when we look at these different ideas we have, whether it's the difference between mind and body, the human relationship with the rest of nature, things like that, a lot of the time my pathways led to cognitive science, which is the science of, you know, basically how humans and other animals perceive the world, how they make sense of the world. And then as I went sort of deeper into that, it was looking at cognitive neuroscience, like how the brain actually works, and cognitive anthropology. Essentially, what is it that differentiates humans from other animals? And then what is it that different cultures do differently from each other? And I realized at the deepest layer, what it is that makes humans kind of unique among other mammals is that we have an instinct to pattern meaning into the universe far more extensively than any other mammal, as far as we know. And we can't really speak for cetaceans, who might be doing it in a way that we can't even conceive of. But as far as we know, we pattern meaning into everything around us, which causes us to develop things like language and culture and ultimately technology. So the book, the title tries to get this essence of what it is that makes humans unique. And then what it unfolds is looking at the different ways in which cultures, or you want to say, might say metacultures, like hunter-gatherer cultures or agrarian cultures, patterned their own meaning into the universe and how that shaped their values and how ultimately those values actually shaped the course of history.
So in some ways, you're going beyond the veil of culture or anthropology or economics or politics. You're going to something that goes to the quick of the subjective experience of living beings, of human beings, and how they construct institutions and forms of meaning that maybe manifest in these different ways.
That's right. And that's why it is difficult to categorize my book, because and both The Patterning Instinct and the Web of Meaning, because really by design, it actually ties in the different categories into something more integrated, which is why I call myself on my website an author and integrator, because I feel that that is an approach to life itself that I'm trying to offer that I think a lot of people relate to, but our society moves in the other direction. Our society very much moves into deintegrating, or you might even say disintegrating, but specifically by separating things out and not really allowing the validity to some expertise or whatever, unless it's utterly separate from something that even may be close to it.
Well, that's what I found refreshing, because you approached it as a non-academic who doesn't have the burden of speaking in oracular, objective terms, neutral terms to his peers, his or her peers, but can speak with a personal voice in a way. Yours is not a memoir by any means, but it does speak to this deep personal meaning.
That's right. And honestly, I believe if I had come from an academic discipline, I don't think I could have written either The Pattern and Instinct or The Web of Meaning, because I would be too afraid of getting shut down by my colleagues. And it's interesting, when you do read people who are trying to be interdisciplinary, oftentimes they'll be in one specific discipline, like maybe it's biology, and they want to sort of add systems thinking into it or something. And you'll see a lot of the time they're very apologetic, and like it's almost like this big major shift they're doing in their own career to add one other element of specialty into their own core specialty. And here am I doing this whole weaving of trying to integrate all elements. And at the same time, though, I've always been very concerned not to be dismissed by mainstream, by serious mainstream thinkers as some sort of new agey, woolly, like woo-woo person who's just kind of being superficial at looking at these connections. And that's why I'm not coming from an academic, professional academic discipline, I have gone to extremes to make sure that every statement I'm making in these two different books, every paragraph is well-researched, footnoted, and only refers, when I do refer to science, only refer to science that has been peer-reviewed and is rigorous. So I'm really trying to set a very solid foundation for what I'm offering.
Well, I'm eager to get into The Web of Meaning, but maybe you could give us a little more substantive idea of some of those patterns of cognition that have, over the course of civilization, evolved.
It turns out there's only a few really big meta patterns, if you will, in the ways that humans have made meaning out of the universe ever since we evolved as humans. Because really, for 95% of our history, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. And even though there's obviously huge differences between the Inuits in the Arctic and people in the Amazon jungle and nomads in the desert or whatever it might be, the amazing thing is how much they share in common, which is a sense of deep interconnectedness, all of life, and the sense of nature being really like a giving parent. Because in every one of these patterns of meaning, what we find is that there's actually a core metaphor that people use and coming out of their embodied experience to then conceptualize what the universe is about. And it's those core metaphors that really help us to understand the implications of their whole worldview. So hunter-gatherers, their core metaphor was a nature as a giving parent, which leads to the notions like, well, then in that case, all sentient beings are relatives. And things like, well, all sentience, therefore, must have intrinsic value if they're all part of the same family. So that's one shift. The biggest shift that really maybe happened in all of human history was when humans began to settle down in agriculture about 10 to 12,000 years ago. There, with that settling, it changed the human experience. So suddenly there was these separations developed between what humans cultivated and the rest of the wilderness out there. And then separations between some farmer who managed to be successful and somebody who was unlucky. So the farmer with success could start to accumulate assets and wealth and power and then hire the other people or exploit them as slaves or whatever it might be, which led to, for the first time in history, in human history, the rise of hierarchies and the view of wealth being a value in itself. That led to this a new core metaphor arising of the universe being really like a hierarchy of the gods, where you need to just sacrifice to them and pray to them and basically try to bribe them to make your life work well. essentially, that is how different agrarian civilizations existed all around the world until a couple of thousand years ago, and really with the ancient Greeks, and then with the rise of Christianity, where a new form of dualism entered human thinking. Basically, rather than this hierarchy of the gods, sacredness was understood as being utterly separate from the world. And even in humans, there was a split between a soul that was this abstract, eternal entity and the body, which was polluted and like a prism. And that dualism actually is what most of us in the world today take for granted. And it was that that led to this final big ontological shift around the 17th century in Europe with the scientific revolution, where this sense of this distinction that was there with dualism went to a whole other level, where humans began to see nature as just a machine. Nature then became a thing, a resource to be exploited. And the development of science, using just our rational thinking, got to be used as a source of power over nature. The metaphor of nature as a machine led to this kind of rallying notion of conquering nature as the underlying meaning of human existence. So those are the fundamental shifts.
Which brings us to the logical conclusion of that way of thinking, which is our planetary crisis and sense of modernity run amok. Is that a fair conclusion to where you end the patterning instinct?
It is, very much so. It's not a coincidence that right around that same period in Europe, over a period of just 100 years or so, we didn't just see the scientific revolution emerge, but we also saw the rise of capitalism. And we saw the rise of colonialism, because each of these three different big concepts have a shared underpinning of the sense that it is right and appropriate to see others as a resource to be exploited. And so this notion of extracting for the sake of your own separate wealth accumulation became fundamental to a value system that led to those three different branches of science, of capitalism, and colonialism, which has led to this incredible imbalance we see in the world today, which could, if it continues at this pace, could lead us to complete disaster.
That must have been a difficult conclusion for a former capitalist such as yourself to come to.
Well, that's interesting. By the time I was coming to that place, I had very much left behind a lot of the values that had led me to start this internet company. And it is interesting, actually, that it was only after years of research that I began to start to research about our present day and where we might be headed, that I began to become increasingly aware of the sort of environmental catastrophe we're facing. Like many people in the mainstream world, I'd seen the headlines. And, you know, as a caring human being, I'd have occasional pangs of sorrow about this extinction event or, you know, what was going on here or there. And as I began to look at how our worldview has led us to today's crisis and the potential for the future, it transformed my whole way of looking at what's going on in the world and my own relationship to it. Because one of the most important things I began to realize is that none of us are separate from what's going on.
Your story prompts me to ask, how does one make a shift from one worldview to another? Because it seems such a structurally powerful phenomena within human life, but it's one of the things most resistant to change. How does one extricate oneself from a harmful worldview? How does one even know one has a worldview?
Well, beginning with that question, that's so important, because a worldview is a little bit like a lens through which we see things. And just as we wouldn't know that our eye is a lens unless somebody explains it to us, similarly, a worldview, we just take so much for granted that we don't recognize it's actually a particular way of framing reality that doesn't have to be the only way of framing reality. And to this point of what does it take to change it? It's interesting, both at the individual and the societal level. I think in both cases, it takes a very severe disruption, which can either be internally, like endogenously driven, or externally driven, and sometimes both together. But it takes a severe disruption so that the things that made sense, the tight woven set of interrelationships between the meaning making, and begins to start unraveling. And I'll give you a couple of examples in terms of societal shift. When the scientific revolution took place, that was more of an internal transformation, where people began to understand the way the world worked in ways that rejected the old Christian traditional dualistic way. And when they did so, a critical mass of people had enough insights together to begin to totally transform things from the inside out. But then if you look at another example of a worldview shift in China, the worldview there, the traditional Confucian worldview, incredibly stable. Really, for 1,000 years or more, essentially the worldview was unchanged. And it wasn't about to change. But then when the West, with their new technology and exploitative approaches, basically came in to dominate China, humiliate the emperor, and essentially undo the bearings of their society, new generations arose saying, we don't accept our old ancestors' ancestor worship and all what our previous generations are telling us. We're going to look to this dominant culture that's come that looks fresh and look to them for new ideas. So when something gets disrupted, a worldview can change quite dramatically. And similarly, on a human level, people tend to, even if they're feeling a sense of dissatisfaction with things, as long as things are kind of okay, they'll just keep going. But when a crisis happens in their own life, maybe either just seeing what's going on in the world around and feeling a deepening sense of discomfort, or something that happens that totally undoes their norms in their life, that's when people look around for a different way of meaning making.
Presumably, they often find helpful guidance from people who write theories or write books. I think of how John Locke helped enunciate a theory of property which justified colonialism, for example.
Right.
That served an important purpose, and it helped focus and lock in a perspective on the world and individuals' relationships with resources known as property.
Right.
Let's move on to your new book, The Web of Meaning. It sounds like you're trying to help articulate a way into a new worldview by articulating the deep linkages between ancient wisdom traditions and contemporary science.
That is right. And in fact, you know, when we were talking before about how I went through my own existential meltdown leading to writing this book, The Patterning Instinct, actually, it led me to do the research. It led both to The Patterning Instinct and this new book, The Web of Meaning, because originally I intended them to be one book, but that was a little bit too big to fit in one cover, I think. But if The Patterning Instinct looked at the ways in which we came to this place, The Web of Meaning is really my own, both personal as well as sort of deeply thought through and scientifically based answer to how we can explore a different worldview that is both intrinsically meaningful and fulfilling to us as living, breathing human beings, and also could lead collectively to humanity redirecting the course of our civilization to one that could actually lead to being essentially in a harmonious, symbiotic relationship with the rest of the living earth. And so that's what I'm sort of putting out there.
You know, there's been a number of authors over the past 40 or 50 years, from Krzysztof Kapra to Lynn Margulis to Joanna Macy, and one could name many others. How does your book try to bring things to a different focus or integration?
You mentioned three of my heroes, and in fact, I refer to the work of each of those three people in this book, The Web of Meaning. And I think what I'm offering in The Web of Meaning that is different qualitatively from what we see in each of those writers, even though I'm building on the amazing work that each of them have put out there, is trying to offer this in an integrated systemic whole piece. So when looking at science and looking at what modern science tells us, to go quite deeply into looking at what evolutionary biology tells us nowadays, to look at what cognitive science tells us, ethology, like the study of animals, tells us, and even cellular biology, system science, complexity science. So looking at what all these sciences tell us, and then tying it in very explicitly with the great insights that have arisen from indigenous knowledge around the world, from Buddhism, from Taoism, and very importantly, from Neo-Confucianism, which most people are very unfamiliar with, but is this amazingly profound and comprehensive worldview that got developed in China about 1,000 years ago that integrated themselves, Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism, into a very systematic way of making sense of things. So what I'm offering in the book is very much like a big picture. The book itself is divided into the great questions that each of us as humans asks ourselves at some point in our lives, like, who am I? What am I? Where am I? How should I live? Or ultimately, like, why am I? And in each of those sections, I look at how our modern worldview gives us answers that are not just dangerous, leading to this destructive path we're on, but plain wrong. That what many people think is scientifically valid truths turn out to be just old, many times repeated myths coming from the 17th century that have not been updated by the findings of modern science.
Well, you've said a mouthful there. To the extent that modern science does continue to operate on the empirical scientific method, are you suggesting that certain contemporary sciences are chafing at the limits of that method? Or how are these contemporary sciences differing from what they've revealed over the past 200, 300 years?
Yeah, that's just a really great point, which I go into in some depth in the book. And I think the important thing is we need to recognize that there is a significant difference between modern science when we think of it as actually a method of inquiry with certain values around it, like empiricism, as you say, or transparency, or there's a number of values around modern science. Big difference between science and what may best be called ontological reductionism. Now, that's kind of a mouthful, so let me explain what that means. Basically, when we think of science, a lot of people hear these statements that one is attributed to the physicist, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Steven Weinberg, who says, basically, the more we know about the universe, the more meaningless it appears. And this is essentially a view of reductionism. And the way that a lot of science has worked ever since the 17th century is by breaking apart the understanding, the investigation into things, whether it's biology, physics, or chemistry, cutting them down to smaller and smaller discrete parts and studying that discrete part and then gaining insights into them. Reductionism as a methodology is important, is brilliant, and it's given us much of the great benefits of science and technology that we enjoy today. So I'm very much a fan of reductionism. However, it's been so successful that there are many people then take that reductionist approach and believe it has to apply to the entire universe, and that the only way you can understand everything about the universe is through reductionism. That's what I call ontological reductionism. And that's where, when you look at modern systems sciences, like systems biology, complexity science, chaos theory, all these different other ways of making sense of things, they're every bit as rigorous and peer-reviewed and transparent and empirical as these other reductionist sciences. But they don't make this ontological leap. They actually say that actually looking at the connections between things can tell us as much and sometimes more about them than just the things themselves.
One might also suggest, as some modern physics has done, that science fails to take account of the role of the embodied self, either in observation or in being implicated in the whole system. In other words, it presumes that there's some objective neutral reality out there that's separate from us as an autonomous mind. Observational effects suggest that we as participants affect the outcome of experiments. It suggests that science has failed to take account of how our consciousness, our motivations, our embodied relations with the rest of the world are consequential too.
That is completely right. And that is another of these myths, really, of ontological reductionism, is that sense that we can look at an objective world that is kind of fixed out there and make sense of it in that way. Really, when you take the true implications of system thinking and not looking at the connectivity between things as being intrinsically meaningful, that does lead to the dissolving of that barrier between the observer and the observed. And that has not just ontological implications, like how we make sense of things, but also ethical implications, moral implications.
This brings to mind my previous podcast interview with our mutual friend, Andreas Weber, who much of his thinking and writing is devoted to how the inner lives of creatures, whether they're slime molds or human beings or other mammals, is consequential for how they evolve and not some side story of evolution. It has an impact for how creatures live, perceive themselves, and develop.
That's right. And in fact, Andreas Weber is somebody who I refer to extensively through the book. His writing was really formative for me in getting a deeper understanding of that sense of sentience in life in general. And I think that's an important theme that really goes through my book, that we begin to recognize that one of these fundamental divides that our culture takes for granted of humans versus the rest of nature. In fact, we even say humans versus nature, as if we are not nature. That fundamental divide is really a fiction, is an artificial barrier that has been set up. And we need to recognize that we have within us that same kind of animate consciousness, as I call it, or animate intelligence that all of other living beings have, even down to the single cell, which I imagine Andreas might have gone into some discussion with you about. Once we recognize that, it helps to build, to rebuild the bridge between us as humans and the rest of life, because we recognize that we are life, that actually we are part of an unfolding epic of life over billions of years. Once we begin to really see ourselves as all of life, it helps to shift our identity from being, again, this kind of mythical creation of the modern worldview tells us that each of us is separate individuals, rational, selfish maximizers, and that's how it's meant to be. And we begin to expand our identity to include basically all of life around us.
It seems that there's kind of a mini explosion of books in this area that maybe haven't quite reached the mainstream, but I just finished reading Merlin Sheldrake's Entangled Life, which is a fantastic survey of networked intelligence and how fungi and mushrooms are fantastically creative and connective and far more important to ecosystems than we realize. And of course, Andreas Weber, and there are many others, The Hidden Lives of Trees.
Right.
Are you optimistic that this sensibility is starting to take root and expand?
Oh, I think it is. Definitely starting to take root and expand. And that does give me one of the most important hopes for the future, even as we see things unraveling in such a terrible way in our society. One of the ways in which we can really get a sense of that is just as you were describing, Sheldrake talks about in The Entangled Life, just how if you're in a forest below you, even though we don't know about it, there's this incredible mycorrhizal fungal network, which actually helps different tree roots to connect with each other through what the biologist Suzanne Simard has called the wood wide web. So it's just like an internet of trees, if you will. But what's so interesting to use that as an analogy for this human shift that's needed is you don't actually see these changes taking place. So if you're walking along the forest, you don't even realize how the trees are right now communicating with each other. And after a rainfall, all of a sudden you might see these mushrooms grow up suddenly, unexpectedly, that you wouldn't have been able to predict because the network, the energy of them was taking place under the ground. So similarly, this new way of looking at our human interconnectedness is like a little bit like a fungal mycorrhizal network of human consciousness, that even while the headlines we read in every newspaper are like the sort of trees crashing around us, this new disaster, that disaster, this underlying, almost like shift in the human collective subconscious of that deep connectedness is, I think, powerfully being enacted.
I've found these recent writings and findings and theorizing so encouraging, because I myself, in trying to think through the commons with my collaborator Silke Helfrich, realized that at a certain point the ontological framing for talking about the commons was wrong or limited, meaning it was within the standard modern economistic framework of rational atomized individuals who are engaging in transactions and game theory propositions, as opposed to the commons as a relational social system, which of course immediately reintegrates us with the rest of life, or indeed asserts the proposition that we are part of life in a very profound way, and let's start to reframe discussions about the commons in that way. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about rethinking biological systems as relational, networked intelligence, and so forth, and how this relates to the commons today.
Yes, I think that's a hugely important subject. And really, quite honestly, when I read your book with Silke Helfrich, Free, Fair, and Alive, last year, you went really deeply into this question and talked about how what's needed is what you call an onto shift or an ontological shift. My light bulbs just went on across my whole sort of field of consciousness. I was going, yes, this is essentially what I'm trying to offer in The Web of Meaning, is really the foundation for the very onto shift that you're calling for in Free, Fair, and Alive. Is this deep recognition that actually, as humans, we're not separate individuals whose kind of ultimate job is to exploit others as much as possible. But we're actually part of an interconnected whole with our community, with all of humanity. And as humans, again, we're not separate from the earth with the job of exploiting it as much as possible, but really exploring places of symbiosis. So I think in all cases, when we're thinking about the commons or thinking about human relationship with each other or the natural world, this concept of mutually beneficial symbiosis is foundational. Because it turns out that actually life itself, rather than being driven by selfish genes trying to outcompete each other, this kind of Richard Dawkins myth that is so central to mainstream thinking, actually evolutionary biologists show that the major evolutionary steps in life, since it first began billions of years ago, came about through different species, different types of organisms, learning how to cooperate more effectively with each other to creating a whole that was far richer and more powerful than the sum of the parts. So similarly, we can take that same approach to our human society, our economic relationships, our social relationships, our power relationships, and realize that trying to exploit others, trying to gain power over, actually leads to not just a zero-sum game, but a negative-sum game. But actually looking at how we can be in symbiosis with each other and can lead to a far more long-term, sustainable, richer flourishing for all, which to my understanding is really is foundational to this notion of commoning as you've described it.
I find it so fascinating that certain segments of science are starting to realize their own ontological mistakes in how they approach phenomena and are starting to get into this relational mindset. But then doubly fascinating is how this is sort of circling back or rendezvousing with ancient wisdom traditions, which have been regarded as irrelevant, archaic, not really meaningful to something as vanguard as science. Tell me a little bit more about the linkages between those two and how they intermingle. Is it simply an overlapping of similarities, or is there something deeper going on here in terms of how science is engaging with it? And is science in some ways confirming these ancient wisdom traditions?
I think that's a good way of looking at it. And I've asked this question myself many times over the years. And because, you know, there's one thing to just say, oh, look, how neat this sage from 2000 years ago is saying something that sounds similar to what we do now. Isn't that cool? That might be nice, but it doesn't have deep meaning. But the question is there something far deeper that we can gain from this confluence of where these different disciplines are leading us to? And I think the answer is yes. So, I mean, we can begin with some sort of simple examples. Like, for example, almost every indigenous tradition talks about how nature, all sentient beings are our relatives, just as I described earlier. And modern science, for most of its time, has like scoffed at that. Well, of course, that's so silly. You know, that's just some ancient myth. More recently, evolutionary biology has discovered that actually, yes, we do all have a shared common ancestor. And we actually share about half of our DNA, even with a banana, never mind with a fruit fly, whatever it might be, that we are truly relatives. And again, this is not just a gee whiz type of realization, but what it helps us to show is something that Andreas Weber has talked about a lot, that at the deepest archetypal layers, we share the experience of what it is to be alive with every other living entity. And that's something where biology has kind of validated indigenous wisdom. But I think if we go to even like a deeper level than that, it has to do a lot with this kind of sciences of connectivity. For example, one of the great leaders in complexity science, an academic called Stuart Kaufman, who's been very involved with the Santa Fe Institute, leading research center. He's written books called things like At Home in the Universe, where he looks at the cosmological and ontological implications of this deep understanding of complexity science. And towards the end of these books, he says things like, you know, we are entering new territory in terms of understanding these breakdown of these barriers between old ideas. And it's a territory that hasn't yet been explored, but there are new principles that we have to understand for how to apply those. And as far as it goes, that's great. But when we realize that actually they are looking at that same cosmos of interconnectedness that Neo-Confucian sages or Taoists or Buddhist wisdom has been looking at for millennia, we realize that actually they are not undiscovered territories. They're territories that have been explored, the ethical and spiritual and societal implications of these of this interconnectedness has been explored deeply by generations of incredibly wise, thoughtful people, which means that if we apply those two together, we can begin to kind of use science to sort of translate these great wisdom traditions into a more scientific framework. And we can then actually allow some of these great wisdom traditions to lead the way to explore what science might actually be able to understand better. So there is this deep confluence between these two ways of knowing.
I remember a conversation I once had with Murray Gell-Mann. What I came away from thinking was, that's really brilliant in terms of the science, but a Sufi could have said it in a 20-word poem just as eloquently and powerfully.
Right. And this is really why I talk a lot about this concept of integration. Because when I describe integration, it's really fundamentally, we can even like define integration as being recognizing the unity in a system along with its differentiation. And so this is the thing about integration, is holding the unity, but holding the differentiation as being just as important as the unit. So an integrated approach to understanding knowledge or understanding wisdom or whatever it might be would not be to say, here's science over there and here's the Sufi sage over there, and can they sort of agree with each other or whatever, but actually looking at the ways in which we can weave those two together to recognize that they both point the way to a deep source of wisdom. And when we use our reasoned brains and that deep intuitive felt insight, they can actually be connected up together in a, what I call a truly integrative intelligence. So we don't have to choose one over the other. And it's my belief that it's only through an integrated intelligence for us as human organisms and an integrated intelligence for us to develop collectively as a human species that we have the potential to actually shift where we're headed, to really be in a much more integrated and deeply symbiotic relationship with the rest of life on Earth.
This points to your own future, and you've told me you're thinking about a new project that would focus on the bases of ecological civilization, and you've already started a nonprofit group called the Leology Institute to help foster a new worldview for such a future. Tell us a little bit about where you see your future thinking proceeding.
In a way, I see these books, The Patterning Instinct and The Web of Meaning, as being the first two books of what I view in my own mind as a trilogy, if you will. Because if The Patterning Instinct really led to The Web of Meaning as really an unfolding of a worldview that could truly lead to a harmonious future for humans on a thriving Earth, it then leads to this question of, well, what would that look like? And actually, the last chapter of The Web of Meaning explores this vision. That's not my personal vision. It's a vision shared by many people that I've become really excited about, of what is called an ecological civilization. The idea of what would a civilization look like if it were built not on a foundation of extractivism and exploitation and wealth accumulation, as our modern civilization is, but if it were built on the principles that have sustained life in ecosystems, sometimes over many millions of years, to maintain rich, exuberant health in spite of all the things that happen to it. And they have a particular way of being applied to human society. But when you apply that, you begin to see there's actually this possibility for humans to rebuild our civilization from the ground up in a way that could actually allow people to achieve well-being, to actually live harmonious and happy lives within themselves and community with the rest of Earth. And this is not just some pipe dream. It's actually stuff that's being done out there. And in fact, to your great credit, so much of the ideas and actual practices you describe about in your books you've written on commoning are absolutely fundamental to these ideas of what's possible as part of an ecological civilization.
That's encouraging to hear, and thank you for citing those commons projects. But I myself wrestle with, are we too embedded in modernity? Have we internalized too many capitalist norms? Are we capable of making this worldview transition to find a better place in a truly ecological civilization? Now, obviously, I believe we can. At the same time, I do wonder how we get there.
Yes. And I myself just want to share that even though a lot of what I generally talk about tends to be viewed as very optimistic, and I'm glad to hear that, I wouldn't necessarily say I myself am an optimist in the sense that I see the disastrous way in which our society is destroying the Earth, is leading to more and more extreme inequalities among our own species and the destruction that's taking place. It's not for me to say what the odds are as to which way we're going to go. But I do believe that what is possible is a transformation of the like that we haven't seen since maybe as big a transformation as that which led to, say, the scientific revolution or even the rise of agriculture. Because one thing we can know about in this current century we're in is that a massive transformation is going to take place. We just don't know which it's going to be. If we keep going on the current way, we're probably going to lead to the total collapse of civilization, or what may be even more morally egregious, a bifurcation in the human species with a tiny elite basically developing their sort of techno-driven techno-utopia while most of humanity suffers in complete breakdown. Either of those are disastrous scenarios, and that's where we're headed right now unless something changes. But what we also know, we were talking before about what does it take for a worldview to change, and I gave the example of China, where younger generations saw their older generation's ideas not working anymore. And they said, we reject that. We're looking for another way of making sense of things. The only place they had to turn to was the Western way, which they did. So right now, we see the Greta Thunberg generation. We see younger generations looking at what's going on, realizing that as they grow into their middle ages, they're going to be living in a society that's falling apart. And they don't necessarily accept what has been accepted for many generations, these fundamentals of capitalism and this worldview of individualism. So they're going to be looking around for a new way of making sense of things. And that's why I believe for those of us who have spent enough years on Earth to be sort of trying to put our own ideas together, that's our great project, really, is to offer these new generations rising right now a way of making sense that actually coheres, that they can put themselves into. And we can see the potential for this massive shift in worldview happening so much faster than we might ever have dreamed.
As we know from physics, many things are nonlinear, and there's a phase shift that happens quite suddenly and often unexpectedly, much as we see in human societies how the Berlin Wall fell and things happened rather quickly after that. So I think that sometimes when I despair that progress seems so slow, I think at the same time it's important to have this horizontal massing and coordination and making sense process to be prepared for when the opening occurs and the dam starts to break. But I agree with you that some large transformation is likely or at least necessary if we're going to get to where we have to go, because the existing system of trying to develop sustainability of humankind divorced from the planet and social equity is just not going to work.
I think that's right. And that's where, interestingly, this whole notion of optimism and pessimism sort of gets turned around a little bit, because you have a significant, very vocal group of people who we might call like the sort of techno-optimists, who say, oh, look at the renewables, look at the reduction in the cost of renewables now, and look at these new kinds of vegan-type meats and all these great things that are happening. Through technology, we can basically have our cake and eat it too. You know, we can keep growing this society in the way that we've done with global capitalism and just enjoy green growth. But as people like Jason Hickel and other hard-nosed economists have shown, green growth is a myth. And it's kind of stunning that even at the United Nations, there's like an official policy that's based on this idea of green growth, which has been shown categorically to be just a made-up fiction. There is no such thing as green growth, meaning like growing the size of the economy without growing the material footprint that we're creating at the same time. So that's why what I say to people looking to make a change and trying to decide where do I invest my own time into to really make a difference is to recognize that some of the easy optimistic answers are actually just essentially some form of greenwashing or other, that they actually aren't answers at all. Anything that happens within the sort of growth-oriented capitalist economy through corporations trying to make as much profit as possible is never, ever going to lead to the transformation we need. So I encourage people to look deeper and look at how they can get involved in a different way of relating to themselves and each other, and that can be part of that a different worldview of connectedness. One of the things I get more excited about than anything is the commons as a new way of making sense of relationships, a new way of organizing and structuring the human project, if you will, in both small ways and global ways.
I love how you end the book with the charge to the reader. what is the sacred and precious strand that you will weave? And it really does come down to individuals weaving their own web in, as you say, a fractal way, meaning it's another pattern that's part of a larger whole.
Exactly. And that's the other thing to really make sense of, that when we look at where the world is headed and what our future holds for us, one of the most important things we can recognize is, just as we were saying before about how physics has begun to understand that there is no objective world out there separate from the person viewing it. So similarly, there is no future out there that is separate from each of us thinking about that future. And the very ways in which we think about it, the very ways in which we relate to it, every statement we make about it, every action we take is actually co-creating that future together. And once we recognize that, on the one hand, there's a freedom for it because we get to realize that we're part of this really amazing, powerful unfolding. And at the same time, there's an awesome responsibility that goes along with it because we realize this is not something that somebody else is doing. Each of us is part of that future.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you so much for you sharing your thoughts and insights and passions with us.
Thank you, David, and it's just been a great pleasure in conversation with you.